This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and today's visit with 92-year-old Dan Cano of Santa Maria, California. Originally from Mercedes, Texas, he enlisted in the Navy at age 17 and would end up on the USS Zilin, an attack transport from which he piloted LCVPs in the Pacific. And for some people, that term LCVP may be a little foreign, Dan.
I'm sure they've seen the photos from Normandy. That's what I think most people associate the LCVPs with, and they see the door come down and the troops run out. But for people who've never seen or never been on an LCVP, describe it for us, how big it is, what you have at your disposal, and how you operate it.
Well, it has a gray marine diesel engine, and they're about 35 feet long, and a capacity of 32 troop men to get into the boat. And it will take a Jeep and a Hauser and all the supplies you can pile in there. You know, you had a certain amount. You watch your water line. You didn't go too far, otherwise you'd sink.
And what is it made out of?
Plywood, 3/4-inch plywood. And we went in on an invasion. They'd handed us a bag of corks, different sizes, to plug the bullet holes. And if you got shrapnel hit the side and it was too big, you had a canvas. The deckhand and the engineer would jump over the side and pull the canvas around and tie it to plug up the hole. Water would seep through, but it wasn't gushing in and keep you from sinking.
So I'm just thinking about when you told your mom, hey, it's no different from the CCC camp. They weren't shooting at you in those camps. And, I mean, if you're going to be protected, really 3/4 of an inch of plywood is all that's separating you from enemy gunfire?
Yeah, but natural instinct, you duck. Even if it was 1/4 of an inch, you figure it's going to save you. But I learned from an article that I came across on MacArthur. He used to walk up to the front lines, standing up, and his aides and everybody laying on the ground telling him, get down, get down. And he'd sit there, survey the whole area, and walk out. And he said, the ones that you hear whistling by, they're gone. So you don't worry about those. The one you worry about is the one you don't hear. Mm-hmm. So then I started sticking my neck out because you got to see where you're going to go because the front end, it's closed. You don't have a view of the area. So I just used to get up and stand there and wait, I guess. I don't know, but I just wanted to make sure I'd get in, unload, and get out. That was the thing.
Well, and you would be part of an invasion that was before what they did at Normandy. This is in November of 1943, and it's a battle that a lot of people don't hear about, but it was every bit as devastating and bloody and important as so many of the other famous Pacific battles. Did you know where you guys were going when you were heading toward Tarawa on the Zilin, that APA?
No, we took trips. When you pull into Pearl, they refurbish the ship and repair it and whatever, and then they load troops on. And you know you're going for a push, but you don't know where. And then after 2 or 3 days out at sea, they call everybody into the room. They unveil the map on the wall and said, we're going to Tarawa. Beto, that was the name of the island. Tarawa is the atoll.
And this is not a very big place. It's, I mean, barely shows up on the map. It's so tiny.
Yeah, it's about 1.5 miles long and not even 1/2 mile wide. But the Japanese have been fortifying it since 20 years or something like that, a long time. Their plan was to colonize every island in the Pacific and control the Pacific. Beta was one of them. And then the biggest one was Truk. They worried about going into that island because there was going to be, it's like going into the mainland of Japan. There was going to be a lot of casualties. That was a fortification. Same way with Tarawa, the commander, he says, if they invade us, it'd take him 100 years to conquer us. So nobody knew where was that. And I found out reading some material that after the war, that we did not have any maps or information of the Pacific. So the Navy Department went to National Geographic and borrowed their maps. And that's all we had. We didn't know. We knew who owned them and what nations and so forth, but we didn't know anything about weather, tides, and all of this. And this is what made it real bad in Tarawa. We went in, and they had no idea that when we went there, it was going to be the lowest tide that had ever taken place. And it was over a half a mile, about three-quarters of a mile, miles from the reef to the beach.
They didn't know where the reefs were or how close to the surface those reefs were. They didn't, from what I've heard, they didn't even consider the possibility that landing craft could get hung up on these coral reefs heading into Tarawa, right?
Yeah.
Had you guys been briefed on the potential for coral reefs or anything?
No, we just figured you're just going to go in and land and come out, you know. But this reef was tremendous. And what they had a dock, and that thing was a good mile or more. They had bombed it, and the end had dropped into the water. That's where the boat officer set up his headquarters at the end of the pier. It was at an angle. It was having trouble, you know, standing up on it, you know. And then they started rigging it up so they can hang on to something, you know. But once we found out that about the low tide, and the first time that they came up with an Amtrak because of this encounter with reefs, they made a tank lighter than the tank. The tracks had blades on it, and they would propel the landing vehicle. But the troops had to jump over the top and into the water. And there was about a good 5 feet or better that you jump from the site into the water. And these guys had all their packs and rifles and everything on them. And if they hit a hole, they went straight down like a rock. So started across the reef, and they just became targets because they could pick them off like shooting deals in a carnival.
And this is one of the big lessons learned at Tarawa, as you're illustrating, is that in future invasions, they sent the frogmen in with explosives to take out some of those reefs to make a path for the landing craft to come in. But you guys are flying completely blind to all that when you get there. So for you personally, walk me through how that invasion unfolded, because you're on your APA, but then you've got to load up your LCVP and take a crew of Marines into Tarawa?
Yeah. We were the second wave, and we had about six boats in a wave. The first wave was the Amtraks, and then we were the second wave. We're going to go follow them. And then once we got there, the boat officer, we had a boat officer that was leading the wave. He saw what the problem was, and we couldn't go no further. And they started communicating, hey, we got a problem. And then the Marines are getting slaughtered, the ones that made it to the beach. We were right at the edge of the reef, and you had to keep moving because they were popping you left and right. You were just sitting targets out there.
So you get up to the reef with 30 or so Marines, and machine gun bullets are hitting your LCVP?
No, I was lucky. I never got hit.
But they're sailing over you. You're hearing them, and you're seeing guys die in front of you.
Seeing boats being hit. And then there was a coastal freighter that used to, it belonged to Australia, I think. That was an Australian coastal freighter that used to go inner island, you know, running supplies and ferrying people back and forth. When the Japanese taken all these islands, they took over that coastal freighter and they used it. And then the Navy sunk it about 25 yards away from the pier, at the end of the pier. And the Japanese had set up machine gun nests on the deal. So, and then once we found out that the only way you could get into the beach was alongside the pier, because they dug the reef out there and there was a channel, and you could go in to the beach, but one boat at a time. So when the first boat went in, the boat officer was in the first boat. He told Johnson, okay, sailor, let's go in. This book that I have, the boat officer says, that kid says was pretty brave. He's just standing out there going into the pier. And then once we got to the pier, the Japanese had built platforms on the pilings, and they strapped themselves to the piling. And as you came by, they'd start shooting at you. They call in the Marines and a flamethrower. They put him on Johnson's boat, and he was going through, and they come to the pier, and the guy pop you, the guy shoot him with a flamethrower. After the battle and everything, Johnson was got the Silver Star, second under the Congressional Medal for his bravery and going in and cleaning that out.
Well, let's talk about your experience. So you take that first crew of Marines in there. You can't get past the reef, right? And do you have a backlog of boats at that point, too, in your way?
Well, yeah, they're all out there waiting. You know, we'd take our turns going in the channel and we'd unloading the troops. So both sides of the channel, our landing on the map, that was Red Beach, and that was our target, Red Beach. So it spread it from the pier, you know, about 100 feet or so. So that was our area to unload, and then the other ones just on down the line. We were supposed to go there, so we started going in on taking turns going in and out of the deal. Then once the tide come in, then we could just go right into the beach. They've been building that thing for 20-some-odd years, and at the very point of the island, if you look at the island from the air, it looks like a bird. And at the top of the head of the bird, they build the bunker. The bombs would bounce off the damn thing. They pile it up with sand and build a bunker, and they build another layer. And then each layer had slits where they could shoot at you. And the planes, you see the bombs just bouncing off the top of the thing. It would not penetrate. So the Marines had to go in there and get to the slits and throw grenades and stuff, work their way up. At the very end, they had an old 8-inch gun that they got from the British or from the First World War. They had it all ranged in. You could come from any angle, and they could pick you off with that 8-inch gun. So they started hitting us. As soon as we got into range, we started getting hit, shelled by the gun.
So you saw some things that you'd never seen before. What were some of the things that you witnessed there that are still in your memory or in, you know, if you close your eyes, you can still picture them?
It was a carnage. All those Marines that got killed trying to get to the beach off those Amtraks and on the beach, the whole beach was just bodies floating in the water. You could probably walk on those bodies all the way across. There's so many of them. And the beach was same littered. I went in, dumped troops, and they put all the wounded in there. They gave us a box of syringes of morphine. They said, just kill the pain and get them back on the ship, bandage them up. And I had to steer the boat, but the deckhand and the engineer were taking care of them. And they brought this Marine. His face, lower part of his face was blown off. He had his notebook. He was a sergeant. He had a notebook. He wrote, it said, no morphine for me. It said, wound in the head. He was conscious, still able to communicate. So all we could do is, you know, put bandages on him and get him back to the ship. God only knows what happened to him. We got back, got restored. But the carnage was what we saw. Because before, all the killings and dead bodies were on the beach. And at Tarawa, it was on the reef. You go online, you know, and Google Tarawa invasion, and there's pictures there of the bodies laying all over the place.
And those pictures had a powerful effect. You know, we hear a lot about the flag raising at Iwo Jima and what that did for the war bond drives and all that. But before that, they were at Tarawa in 1943, and the photos and even a movie, they made a documentary of that invasion that won an Oscar, but also had the effect of getting Americans' attention of what the fight against the Japanese was going to be like, and certainly that proved true. But you're there witnessing all this, and you're a teenager. You're what, 18 years old and looking at bodies that are mangled and guys that are killed, and you're getting handwritten notes from a Marine who's so brave and so courageous that he doesn't even want morphine with a face that's blown apart. How did you process all of that? How did you keep doing your job in the midst of that horror?
Well, you have to keep on going. You couldn't stop. I mean, you got to save yourself. You know, you got to save everybody. My job on that boat, I was the captain. Nimitz couldn't tell me what to do. He says, just take me to my ship. But Ken said, but before you do this for me. He can't tell me that because I'm the captain.
And you're not just saying that figuratively. You actually have a story about that. But how long were you there at Tarawa?
Well, the duration from the invasion till we secured.
So that whole time you're taking trips to and from your APA to drop off Marines and then bring back the Marines who've been chewed up and spit out.
Yeah. And we had to unload every ship, all the supplies that those ships had. We had to unload all the supplies. They were piled up on the beach. And there were people that would remain. I remained behind in Kwajalein to build the base.
Which is how he ended up transporting one very high-ranking passenger. You can find a photo of that incident at hometownheroesradio.com or the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. But you'll hear 92-year-old Dan Cano explain it when Hometown Heroes comes right back after this.